This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Charlie Lovett was drawn to the mystique of old books as a young kid. When he was a teenager, he often went into old houses and rummaged through boxes headed to Goodwill to find books that he thought had value and importance. He later opened his own antiquarian bookshop and considered his job to be one big treasure hunt, a mission to rescue culture. He now has his own large collection of rare books and artifacts about the author of Alice in Wonderland, Lewis Carroll. But he recently switched his attention to writing novels about the world that he has been immersed in for years. His new work, First Impressions, tells the story of a book lover who is trying to uncover the truth about Jane Austen and the writing of Pride and Prejudice. Charlie Lovett joins me in the studio today to talk about First Impressions. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, it's good to be here.
It's good to have you here. Let's talk about your obsession with, your love of antique books. So when did it start? What is it about these books?
Well, my father was both an English professor and a book collector. So I grew up in this home where not only was text valued, but physical books as objects were valued as well. And I saw him enjoying that hobby, and I thought it looked like fun. So as I started being old enough to sort of travel on my own, I would pop into, there used to be, you know, used and rare bookstores all over the place in those days, and I would pop in and try to find a copy of a book that would interest him. And that became my own hobby as well, and so it's continued to this day.
Is there a point at which the contents of the book really don't matter? I mean, it's the idea that it's a first edition or the way it's printed or published.
Well, it sort of depends on the book. I mean, there certainly are what you would call art books, where the whole point of the book is the physical manifestation, and that the text is almost secondary to that. But I like it when the text and the physical object sort of work together. Mm. I love the idea of this triangular relationship between reader and text and physical book, and that's one of the things I sort of explore in my novels.
Well, you owned an antiquarian bookshop for a while. What was that like?
It was fun. You would get calls from people to say, can you come and, you know, look at this house full of books? And sometimes you would find a house that meant you had to find a kind way to say, maybe these have more sentimental value than they have resale value. And then once in a while, you would find something really amazing, and you would feel wonderful feeling that you get when you rescue something that might have otherwise gone into the trash or down to Goodwill, and you're able to find somebody who is going to really love and care for a book that deserves to be preserved for the next generation.
Well, as you say, you explore that relationship between that triangular relationship, as you said, between reader, book, and text and author in First Impressions. Tell us about the book. Set it up for us.
Sure. There are two stories in First Impressions. There is a story that's set in the present day about a young woman named Sophie Collingwood. She's recently finished her studies at Oxford University. She's gone to work at an antiquarian bookstore. And like a lot of young people in their mid-20s and a lot of Jane Austen heroines, she's trying to find her path in the world, both in terms of romance and relationships, but also just in terms of what is she going to do with her life and where is she going to go. And then there's another story that is told in parallel, which is the story of another young woman trying to find her path in life, and it's a young woman named Jane Austen. And we meet her in 1796 when she's only 20 years old, but she's already writing the first drafts of the novels that will become Sense and Sensibility and Pride and Prejudice, which when I think about what I was doing when I was 20 years old, that impresses me quite a bit. And so these two stories proceed in parallel, and eventually Sophie finds herself on the trail of a particular rare book that has a previously unknown Jane Austen connection, and that takes her into a mystery that involves not only Jane Austen, but her own romance with two different suitors and some peril and some investigation in old libraries and all the sorts of things that we bibliophiles like.
Yeah, and there's no better mystery than one that takes place in an old library, I'll tell you. I mean, everything about it, the musty books, the possibility of codes and hidden messages in the text itself is kind of great. Would you read for us?
Sure. I'm going to read a short little scene, and this is from a conversation that when we first meet Jane Austen, she has just become acquainted with a much older clergyman. He's about 80 years old and she's 20 years old. And it turns out that they both very much like novels and reading, but the first conversation they have with each other, they're sort of teasing each other a bit about that. "It may shock you, Miss Austen, but in fact, I was reading a novel." "A novel? You do shock me, sir. Do you not find novels full of nonsense? I myself find them the stupidest things in creation." "Then you read novels?" "Novels. I'm surprised at you, Mr. Mansfield, suggesting that a young lady such as myself, the daughter of a clergyman, no less, could occupy her time with such horrid things as novels." "You tease me, Miss Austen." Indeed, I do not, Mr. Mansfield. For though you know that I aspire to write novels, you cannot expect that I would take my interest in the form so far as to actually read them.
Charlie Lovett reading from his novel First Impressions, and that is one of the stories in parallel in this book, the story of Jane Austen. It takes us back, and of course it reminds us of the clergyman in Pride and Prejudice, Mr. Collins, who famously is proud of the fact that he doesn't read novels, right? I
mean, yeah, Jane Austen in her novels frequently pokes fun at the whole idea of novels, especially in the novel Northanger Abbey, which itself is a sort of a parody of the Gothic novels of the day. But the novel was sort of a new form at the time that she was writing, and was looked down on by the establishment as sort of not really worthy of critical mention.
What's really fun about the book, too, is you take on the form, novel, the artifact, right, the book itself, words themselves, and then, of course, you write a novel in the process, and all these forms kind of play with each other throughout the book. What about the research? I mean, because now you've got a historical figure, Jane Austen, that you have to deal with, who has a body of work that you have to contend with, how did you handle the research?
Well, I was very aware from the beginning that I was writing Jane Austen not as the subject of a biography, but as a fictional character in a novel. So I wanted to get the basic facts of her life correct. I wanted her to be living in the right places at the right times and writing her novels when she really did write her novels and having the, you know, correct family members. But I didn't want to get caught up in the minutiae of her biography as I created a character. So to create her character, what I did was I went back and reread the novels. And from that, I sort of stepped backwards and said, okay, what kind of person, what sort of personality would write novels like this in the late 18th and early 19th century? And my answer to that question, first and foremost, was somebody with a great sense of humor. I mean, they're very, very witty novels, but also someone who was keenly intelligent, very aware of the human condition, sharply perceptive, and also sort of quietly revolutionary, a bold young woman who's not afraid to assert herself in a world traditionally dominated by older men.
Her fearlessness reflected in her choice of career. On the other hand, she becomes the master of irony because, again, wit at the pen and in the mouths of women was considered dangerous at the time.
Yeah, and she's really remarkably witty. I mean, I first approached Jane Austen, believe it or not, as a 12-year-old boy, thinking that I should be reading more serious books because I get good grades in my English class. And since my father taught Jane Austen, I thought, well, maybe that's something I should read. And I'm not sure what her originally intended audience was, but I'm almost certain it wasn't 12-year-old boys of the 1970s. Yeah. So it wasn't really until I came back to Jane Austen as an adult that I saw that wit in the way that she draws her characters. And I think sometimes, especially in the way she draws the unpleasant characters, like you mentioned Mr. Collins, and there's many others who she can just with a few sentences give you a really keen perception and a good laugh at the same time.
And if you're not keenly perceptive yourself, you're going to miss it, which is the way she, as you say, is subversive and in many ways revolutionary. Old books are also characters in your novel, how did you make them come alive?
Well, it's true. My first book was called The Bookman's Tale, and it was centered on a book from about the 1590s that may or may not have had marginal writings in it by William Shakespeare. And so that book, we sort of followed it through about 300 years of history, and it really was a character. In this book, I had this idea, because as book collectors, we're so often obsessed with the idea of collecting first editions, as you already mentioned. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, what if there were a book out there where the first edition really wasn't worth anything? It was just a sort of a worthless piece of junk. But the second edition was a priceless literary artifact. And sort of questioning why that might be led me to create this character, if you will, of a book called The Little Book of Allegories, which is the book that Richard Mansfield, the elderly clergyman, has written, and which has given him a little bit of experience in the writing world, enough to sort of be very encouraging to Jane Austen, and also enough for him to understand she is a far more talented author than he will ever be, and that he should encourage this young person in this pursuit. So the book becomes part of that relationship.
And we've been talking about Jane Austen, but you mentioned Sophie, who's the contemporary character in this book. Tell us more about her.
Sure. Sophie grew up in a big sort of country home, the sort of home you like to tour in England on the weekends. And it has a huge library in the middle of the house, but the library is always kept locked up for reasons that I will not reveal because I don't want to spoil too much. But she really has to depend on her Uncle Bertram, her father's brother, to introduce her to this world of books and of reading and of literature and collecting. And she goes to visit him in London in his flat when she's 8 years old. He takes her out to the theater as a Christmas treat, and he brings her back to the flat. And she discovers in one evening, there's the flat is just filled with books from floor to ceiling in every room. And she discovers all at once this amazing world of books and literature and leather bindings and cloth, worn cloth spines. And she just falls in absolutely in love with it.
And in both of these characters now that you've created in First Impressions, Jane Austen and Sophie both have mentors.
They do. You know, one of the words that we use in the subtitle is unexpected love. And I wanted to explore, although Sophie is involved in a sort of a traditional young person's romance, I wanted to explore some different types of love. And so they both have much older men with whom they have very loving but non-romantic relationships. And they are sort of the relationship of the mentor and the teacher. But I think they extend beyond that, that there really is there's a real sort of meeting of the minds between Jane Austen and Richard Mansfield and between Sophie and her Uncle Bertram.
Can I get you to read again for us?
Sure. This is the scene where Sophie first has come to Uncle Bertram's apartment and he offers to read her a story, and she sort of has that wonderful experience of just encountering literature all at once for the first time. Uncle Bertram began to read, and Sophie's world was transformed. The Wind and the Willows, Chapter 1, The Riverbank. Sophie closed her eyes and fell into the story. After every chapter, Uncle Bertram said, "Perhaps that's enough for now." But chapter after chapter, Sophie pestered him for more, until finally he said, "I think it's time we switched to another book. I do believe it's past your bedtime." "What's this one called?" she asked when Uncle Bertram drew a small, fragile-looking volume from the shelf next to her bed. "The Odes of Horace," he said. But this time, when he began to read, the words made no sense to Sophie. "I don't understand," she said. "It's Latin," replied Uncle Bertram. "Think of it as music, and just listen." And so she fell asleep to the musical sound of Uncle Bertram intoning Horace, and she had never been happier.
There's Charlie Lovett reading from his novel First Impressions. You know, what's interesting, too, now you introduce in that the idea of Latin as something that whose meaning you may not get, but is a kind of music, the word as artifact, as a thing.
Yeah, and I think you see that in English literature, too. Certainly you see that in Shakespeare. I mean, I remember I was doing a fair amount of Shakespeare when my daughter was in about third grade. She came to see me in Othello, and we used to take her. We lived in England for 6 months when she was 9 years old, and we took her to lots of Shakespeare. And we started to realize that for a child of that age, they certainly aren't going to understand every word. Some of it is just going to be like music. But like music, they can get the general idea of it. They can understand the story sometimes better than an adult because they're not sort of hung up on that needing to understand every single word. So I think I do love, although I'm not a poet, I love the rhythms of language and the musicality of a well put together sentence.
Well, you know, for people who want to parse what is literature versus other kinds of writing and what makes something literature, I think it's if you realize, I mean, you think about words, they're simply symbols. They're all symbols. And then we craft them into books or whatever other forms. So probably the artist or the writer who can capture both the symbolism of the rhythm and the sound and the music and the symbolism of the word and the artifact of the medium itself, when you can bring all those things together, you may then have a work of art.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think one of the wonderful things about working in the English language is we have this incredible richness of vocabulary and syntax that gives you all sorts of options to make a sentence not just say what you mean for it to say, but feel the way you want it to feel and sound the way you want it to sound.
You had a kind of an experience. You actually had a copy of a first edition of Pride and Prejudice in your hands?
Yes. When I finished writing the second draft of this book and I was sending it back off to my agent, that afternoon I went over to Wake Forest University. I live in Winston-Salem. And they have a first edition of Pride and Prejudice there in the library at the Rare Book Room. And so I just had because I had written a scene where Sophie sits down and reads the beginning of that book, I thought I would like to have that experience too. And it's an amazing thing to read those unbelievably familiar words in the form that they appeared at the very beginning of their lives when the people who first encountered them were not reading familiar words. They were reading something completely new. And we actually had one of the librarians brought the book over to my book launch in Winston-Salem about a month ago, which made me at best the second most interesting thing at my own book launch. But it was great fun to have that and to be able to share that with the people there.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. First of all, what you just said, the idea that this is what it looked like when people didn't know this book. It wasn't yet famous. But also that book passed through many hands before it got locked up in a library.
Yeah, and one of the things I really love about old books is that history of ownership. It becomes a big part of the plot of The Bookman's Tale, my first book, because the hero of the book has to sort of trace the history of the ownership of this book to figure out whether it's authentic or not. But I love picking up an old book and understanding that it is the product not just of an author, but of a printer and a binder and one owner and another owner and somebody who used it as a coaster and somebody who read it and loved it and somebody who, you know, dropped a tear or a glass of wine on the back page. And all that becomes sort of part of this history. And I think a great old book sort of lives in many times at once. And that's a great sort of connection to have. And it's something I like to explore in the novels as well.
As you have done, Charlie, thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you, Frank.
Charlie Lovett, who is the author of the new novel, First Impressions. He's going to be reading from his book at Belk Library at Appalachian State tomorrow, Chapel Hill Public Library in December. You can find out details and all of the readings and references to anything that we have talked about on The State of Things at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is a program produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Alex Curley is our intern. Robin Copley, the technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.